May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant Shakira Wonham. When the trial court conducted its own faulty finding of fact, it prevented 17-year-old Ms. Wonham from arguing to the jury that she committed the robbery and felony murder of Johnny Jackson because she was coerced by 24-year-old, 6'3", 295-pound, gun-carrying, drug-dealing Stephen Martin. Additionally, the trial court, without reviewing any of the evidence and entertaining any legal argument or conducting any analysis, prevented Ms. Wonham from presenting evidence to the jury that would have allowed them to understand the circumstances under which she perceived the coercion. Because of these two errors, Ms. Wonham's conviction should be reversed. Well before trial, defense counsel provided the state with notification that Dr. Schneider, a licensed psychologist and attorney, had conducted a psychological evaluation of Ms. Wonham. Defense counsel also provided the state with that report. It was in response to that that the state actually filed a motion in limine to preclude the use of the psychological report and preclude the use of a duress defense. Only 3 days later, without reading the report, without allowing defense counsel to respond as he had requested, and without conducting any analysis or hearing, the trial court granted the motion with respect to the preclusion of the psychological report.
I take it, but tell me if I'm off base on this, that the motion to exclude the report and your side's effort to obtain the admissibility of the report and evidence, had you succeeded on that, would have that report would have gotten into evidence through the actual trial testimony of the expert that prepared
yes,
the report.
Yes, that is correct.
So it's not just the report, but it's the expert testimony as
That's
well.
Correct, Your Honor.
If we're going to focus for a moment on the expert testimony, can you explain to me how the expert testimony would have helped the jury understand the facts that underlay the duress defense? Now, let's put aside for a moment whether it was error or not error to charge the jury on duress or allow the defendant to testify about duress. But why was expert testimony necessary for the jury to understand the duress defense?
Well, Your Honor, upon reviewing the commentary to the duress defense, it became clear that there are several factors that the jury gets to weigh. And other states, including New Jersey, New York, New Mexico, and it goes on, have found that in an objective standard state, which Delaware is, this type of evidence actually assists the jury in determining, first, whether Ms. Wonham's perception was sincere, secondly, whether she did, in fact, have ample opportunity to escape, and it also lends credibility to the actual defense. And here's why. The state presented a two-hour, three-hour, whatever it was, a sliver of time, and says there was no explicit threat there, therefore she was not under duress. This report would allow the jury to look at a wider time frame to see the context under which this occurred and allow the jury to see that there was a dynamic where there was a threat hovering over every interaction between Mr. Martin and Ms. Wonham. So it would actually have provided them with a bigger picture. And in the commentary, the commentators noted that there can't be a hard and fast rule. You have to look to the facts of each case, and that's for the jury to decide.
What about the state's argument that the duress statute as it was originally conceived in the penal code and the commentary that addressed it no longer relevant because the General Assembly's actions in regard to guilty but mentally ill have obviated the purpose for which you wanted to use the duress statute in this case?
Well, their argument actually misunderstands what Ms. Wonham's trying to do. They're correct. 401 did limit what the excuse of culpability based on mental health and mental illness. What Ms. Wonham is not trying to do that here. What Ms. Wonham is trying to do is present to the jury evidence that was reviewed by and relayed by an expert based on objective sources to present circumstances for the jury to decide whether she sincerely perceived the threat.
Go ahead. Complete your answer.
So it's not that we're going to contend that because she was bipolar or because she had post-traumatic stress disorder, she was susceptible. There are states that have allowed that type of evidence to come in to support a duress defense. But it's more than that. The report contained a history of abuse being perpetrated on her over time by older men, and more specifically, a history of abuse by Mr. Martin upon her.
Ms. Walker, we have a much more basic issue, don't we? If I understand the ruling of the trial judge correctly, it's that there is no duress defense unless the person who's exerting the duress essentially has a gun pointed to the head of the defendant or something close to it. And since that wasn't the case here, that is, we didn't have anything that comes close to that. You know, there's a separation in time and distance between the threat and the actual commission of the crime. As a matter of law, there's no duress. And I suppose that from that it would follow that the expert testimony that you sought to introduce was irrelevant, and there's no need to instruct the jury because there's no defense anyway as a matter of law. That is, all of the arguments, the secondary arguments you're making, would flow from that first ruling. What's wrong with that ruling?
Well, what's wrong with it is, first, the court did not use the proper legal standard in determining whether there was actually a duress defense. The standard is whether any hypothetical juror could not decide that there was duress. Secondly, the court conducted a fact-finding, which is not...
I don't understand the way you phrase it.
I'm sorry.
Any hypothetical juror could not decide that there was duress. I don't understand that. Can you rephrase that?
I'm sorry. The court could only deny a duress defense instruction if she finds no hypothetical reasonable jury could find the fact find as a fact that she was under duress.
Okay, thank you.
And what kind of threat is required? It's an actual threat, right?
Well, it's under the perception of the defendant, and that's for the jury to decide. She got up there and she testified, "I felt threatened because he beat me before when he told me to rob someone and I didn't do it." So she felt, if you believe her testimony, which is the standard here, that she was going to be beaten if she didn't do what she was told.
So just to expand on that concept, if you have a gang, for instance, and the leader of the gang regularly beats people in the gang, but then says the same thing, "I want you to go rob someone," and that other gang member does that, shoots them, kills them, the duress defense would be available to that gang member?
Under Delaware law, that's correct, because the commentary states that the factors that are involved are for the jury to decide. For example, the jury is to decide whether the threat was immediate enough, whether or not she did, in fact, have the opportunity to escape. That's why the report, for example, is extremely important. Because if, as the state argues, there has to be an explicit threat, then that would be in the judge's hands, and it would be a barrier to the duress defense. And the commentary specifically took it out of the judge's hands and put it in the jury's hands. And that's why the jury gets to weigh that in the context of all the facts and circumstances. So while it's the defendant's situation that's important and the facts of that case. So while he may not have specifically said, "If you don't rob this person, I'm going to kill you," that does not end the discussion. She got up there and said, he beat me before because I didn't do this, and I was scared. That's enough for a duress defense.
This is an affirmative defense and not just a defense, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So the defendant has the burden of producing some credible evidence on each of the elements of the defense.
That's correct.
And the trial judge is a gatekeeper to the extent that she can conclude that the defense hasn't presented credible evidence on one or more of those elements, correct?
That's correct.
Was that the decision that the trial judge made or not?
But no, she did not. That's the legal standard required under 11 Delaware Code 303 in Gutierrez versus State. She didn't do that. She did what the jury is supposed to do, and she made findings of fact, incorrect findings. She said, "I don't think the word beating was ever used. There was no evidence at any time that he was ever forceful to her or violence. She didn't testify that he ever said, 'If you don't do such and such, I'm going to beat you.'" Interestingly, I think, is the fact that the court also said to defense counsel, "I don't have her testimony available to me, quote, but I probably could get it in a second," end quote. She never did that, even though defense counsel questioned her memory on that. So not only did she not conduct the legal test, she conducted the jury's function, and she did it based on faulty memory.
I want to get back to the legal test, because we have a series of statutes on justification, including self-defense, which expressly refers to as the defendant, or in this case it would be your client, for instance, how that person's state of mind, what that person believed the circumstances to be. Isn't that type of description absent from the duress statute?
That particular language is, but what is present in the duress statute is it's based on the defendant's situation. And the commentator specifically stated, because of that, there can be no hard and fast rule. We have to look to the facts of each case. And whether her perception is sincere, the state has even conceded that that's relevant. And it's also, they also indicated that her relationship with Martin would have been helpful in determining that. So at least on one factor, the state has acknowledged that it was important to have that type of evidence.
Justice Ridgely's question really poses, I think, once again, the fundamental issue that concerns me, and that is, what are the outer boundaries of the duress defense? Do we have duress here? Your argument is, yes, we do. But the question we're going to have to decide is, how far removed in time and space does the threat have to be? In your brief, the cases that you appear to rely on are battered spouse syndrome mm-hmm. cases. And in those cases, the facts are very different, aren't they? That is, the person that gets shot is the spouse that does the battering. Here we have essentially a victim that's a third party to the allegedly duressed relationship between the duressor and the duressee.
Well, the court is correct. That's the classic battered wife syndrome. I believe a lot of the cases, in all honesty, do deal with third party getting injured. The question is, in the battered wife syndrome, if the court is applying that as beating the batterer, would be a self-defense situation and not duress. But here, there can't be a hard and fast rule, as I stated. So we can't say, well, if it was 2 days before, there's no duress. If it was 3 days before, there's no duress. If you didn't specifically say XYZ, there's no duress. That's very clear from the standard. The pattern of threats in the relationship with Martin is very significant.
Well, what about the disparity between the threat and the ultimate crime? In this particular case, your client's saying, I was under duress when I committed the homicide because I feared another beating. How, as a matter of law, does that get you a jury instruction on duress?
Well, there's 2 points to that. The first is there's nothing that precludes that there has to be a balance. It's specifically stated in the self-defense and defense of property statute that it has to be equal level of force. However, there's a couple of possibilities that the jury could have reached. One could have been that she was under duress for the robbery, which arguably would have been more in line with the beating. The other is she could have gotten duress for the robbery and the homicide, which we're arguing she should have been permitted to get that instruction. So, again, this statute doesn't specifically say it has to be related. That's something for the jury to decide. The jury's the one to say, well, she said he didn't give her an explicit threat, and she was in the car with them for a period of time and had a chance to get away, and that's what the state's saying. And they could have believed that, but that was for them to make that decision and said,
your argument, we know this isn't a circumstance where you have somebody's loved one held hostage at gunpoint and you say to them, go do something or else I'm going to kill or injure your loved one. But it seems here that most people, given the choice of committing a robbery or a homicide or getting a beating, once they got away from the person threatening them, would just leave. And you're saying expert testimony was needed in this case to demonstrate why leaving and escaping was not an option for her?
That's correct. What the state's argument still on appeal, is that because she was able to get in the car and get away, that was enough to preclude the defense. The expert testimony would have shed light on the fact that because of the nature of the abusive relationship, she may have felt that she had no escape from getting away from him. She also testified that she said, I came back with, I pretended I robbed somebody, and he didn't buy it, Another time, this particular time, she was afraid that he would hurt her family. So there was that as well that was overlaying this. And again, you know, the expert testimony is very relevant for these very reasons that the court is raising. These are findings of fact for the jury. As long as she testifies, I was afraid he would beat me if I didn't do it. And the testimony is clear that he put the gun in her hand, he wiped his prints off of it, he told her to go rob somebody, he said, don't let go of the gun, he said, here's the cell phone, call somebody. So the facts are clear, and then after the fact, he took the money and the cell phone from her, took her clothes, bleached them, put her in a car, headed to New Jersey, burned her clothes. So not only is there her claim that he was beating her, would beat her, there was his actual actions that support what she's claiming. And I think that's what's important to consider that in the circumstances.
I'm having a little bit of trouble with the remoteness argument, if you will. Maybe that's not what it's called. But you seem to be suggesting that if a defendant claims that he or she did something out of fear that somebody else was going to hurt them or their family, that that opens the door to a duress affirmative defense. And I'm wondering whether aren't there some points at which, as a matter of law, a court can say, no, you know, nice try, but even if you honestly believe it, the circumstances are such that the jury is not going to hear this claim of yours. Isn't there a line somewhere?
Well, yes, I think it's not a clear-cut line, but what would happen would be the test in 303 would apply, and that is whether any hypothetical juror, let's say this backwards again, whether there's if a hypothetical reasonable jury could not find duress, then the instruction wouldn't be given. So, for example, if she got up there and testified, and we didn't hear anything about this Martin guy and his involvement in the crime, and she said, my boyfriend, you know, in the past threatened me and I was just scared. That would be a closer call, and that would be for the court to say, you know, there's no evidence here that would support that she was scared.
Well, one of your arguments seems to be that if the trial judge is acting as the gatekeeper on the duress affirmative defense and has to reach a conclusion that tests the remoteness and the sincerity and all the rest of that in terms of whether there's credible evidence, that one of the mistakes the trial judge made was she never read the expert witness report.
Correct.
She didn't know all the evidence that might have been present to support the duress defense, and therefore she couldn't have done, as a matter of law, the kind of gatekeeping function that some of the questions have suggested she should have done.
That's correct.
Or could have done.
The defense was in a position where they were hamstrung and could only present an undeveloped theory of the defense. So even if this court were to rule that in and of itself wasn't sufficient for duress defense, the fact that there was this other evidence out there that the court didn't even look at and the defendant was prevented from presenting makes her that decision incorrect.
And in terms of what your client said, didn't your client say that she actually shot the victim not because of duress or for any reason or anything that happened back at the apartment, but because she was afraid that the victim would take the gun and shoot her? Is that true?
Her testimony was, yes.
Okay. Now, doesn't that blow the duress defense out of the water from her own mouth?
No.
Why not?
Because Mr. Martin told her as he was handing her the gun, do not let anybody take this gun. She's testified that she asked him for the money, demanded the money. The guy went and grabbed the gun. She closed her eyes, and all that went through her head was him saying, don't let him take the gun, don't let him take the gun, and she starts spraying sporadically. Now, if the court says that's not enough for duress instruction on the homicide, she still has the duress for the robbery, and that would fall out. And if that fell out, then there can't be a felony murder. There could possibly be a lesser homicide available. But defense counsel's request was requesting duress for all the offenses involved in this, but these are the specific offenses being addressed. Does the court have any other questions? questions.
You want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, please.
All right. Thanks.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the State. As an initial matter, the State would point out that the question of the psychological report being precluded from evidence is a matter that there is not a clear record on for review. The defense never requested, never gave notice in discovery that they had an expert that they wanted to testify. There is no way this report could get in without an expert. That was a clear violation of the discovery rules. And, in fact, the judge had asked if there was going to be any mental condition evidence and gave a specific deadline for that notification. No notification was made.
What's the term of art, mental condition? How do we analyze that? Is that a legal term of art?
That was the wording of the judge, was that it, because
well,
there, Rule
been,
12.
That doesn't make it understandable necessarily.
Okay. Rule 12.2 specifically states about notification regarding expert testimony on defendant's mental condition, and that would be the reference for
if
that.
If it doesn't equate to mental illness as a defense.
That is correct. It states, if a defendant intends to introduce expert testimony relating to a mental illness, defect, psychiatric disorder, or any other mental or emotional condition of the defendant bearing upon the issue of guilt, and it requires the defendant to give notice. That notice was not given. They did turn over the report. However, it was in plea negotiations, and it was after the date of cutoff for the mental condition notice given by the judge.
Well, wait a second. Did the trial court make its ruling on the basis of failure to comply with the rule or a deadline and timing?
No, apparently not.
Well, so are you suggesting that if the trial court's decision was wrong on the question of relevance, we should affirm in any case because the defendant didn't go through the proper procedure to present this evidence to the court?
Yes. That is a basis upon which the court could affirm because the judge could have, in fact, kept it out simply as a discovery violation. However, the State also contends that the judge was correct, that it would not have been relevant.
Even though the court never read the report?
There was no indication that there was any defense related to any mental condition.
Was there an offer of proof? I mean, the judge didn't read the report, but in order to determine that the report was irrelevant, there had to be some offers to what the contents of the report would have been.
There was no proffer. The judge did not actually allow defense counsel to present anything regarding the report. But pointed out that unless the defense was presenting a guilty but mentally ill, it would not be relevant during the guilt phase.
Yeah, this got before the court based on the State's motion, is that correct?
That is correct.
So you have the State's motion in limine to exclude the report.
Yes.
And the court grants the State's motion to exclude the report without reading the report.
Yes.
And going back to Justice Berger's question, you could possibly see where the court would do that based on it being untimely under the rule.
Yes.
But if it's not based on it being untimely, how do you rule on the merits of excluding the report without reading it?
The State certainly believes it would be a better practice to read before ruling. There's no question on that. However, in this case, ultimately, it was the correct decision and didn't impact the trial.
Isn't it the case that the only logical way that the court could have ruled as it did, and this is basically by way of follow-up to Justice Holland's question, is that the court had already decided that as a matter of law there was no duress defense. So it didn't matter what the evidence of duress was.
No, the court, it would appear that the court would have needed to determine that there was no mental condition at issue in the trial, which would be a fair assumption for the court to make since nothing had been filed in the case to indicate that anybody would be presenting anything regarding mental condition that would relate to the health, to the guilt of the defendant.
But the way Ms. Walker outlines the scenario she contemplates, it would be for the defendant to testify and then to present expert testimony in support of what the defendant said. But here we have a pretrial motion in limine, don't we?
Yes.
So what's the basis for the trial court's ruling that duress is out of the case as a matter of law?
Oh, the court did not rule that duress was out at that point. That the she reserved judgment on the issue of the duress instruction at that time. She only kept the report out. She did not, certainly did not stop at that point rule on the duress.
Well, that compounds it to the extent that the court leaves duress open as an issue in the case because it raises the question, what's the basis for excluding the report that the defense wanted to present in conjunction with the defense that had not been ruled out?
Because the duress defense is an objective test, and the mental condition of the defendant is not relevant to a duress defense. As counsel pointed out, the situation the defendant was in terms of perceiving a threat, the size of her alleged coercer, her relationship with him, that was relevant to whether she felt threatened. However, the information regarding any relationship she had with Mr. Martin, the information in the psych report would be just what the defendant had told the psychologist.
You bring the state's position down to this legal question. What you're saying is the Superior Court properly ruled that even if you present duress as a defense, as a matter of law, you can never support it with expert testimony.
That's correct.
Because therefore, there's no need to read the expert's report because the court's saying we just don't permit experts to testify in support of a duress defense.
That is correct. It's an objective standard. It's a two-part test. Basically, the test is someone made me do it. I couldn't get away. Two parts. Regardless of the what one could term subjective portion of that, was the threat perceived, was it real, was it there? The second part, which is I couldn't get away, there was no evidence of that at trial at all. And for defense counsel to suggest that defendant should have expert testimony as to why, given her background of beatings and her horrible childhood, she would not have been able to get away when anybody else certainly could have. She was separated from the coercer. She was at a friend's house for hours with a phone.
I thought and this is the code commentary, the absence of a chance of escape or of self-defense is also a jury question but is not made a condition of the availability of the defense.
It's a two-part test. That clearly, reading the statute, there are two parts to it. And the second part is reasonable person couldn't get away.
Well, but the issue is who determines that? Do you agree that the trial judge's gatekeeper function requires her to conclude whether or not credible evidence has been proffered by the defense on each of the elements of the affirmative defense of duress?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did she analyze it in that way here in the absence of reading the report to see whether the report had any effect of bringing credible evidence on either of the two-factor tests that you've described?
Well, you
seem to assume that because it's an expert's report, it can't be the product or it can't produce objective evidence. I'm not sure I'm convinced of that. You seem to rule it out because the statute calls for an objective test and that apparently no expert testimony can bring to light facts that address an objective test. How can we be confident that the trial judge did her job here when she didn't read the report at all?
As the state said, it certainly would have been a better practice to read it. However, there is nothing that a psychologist testifying as an expert or producing an expert report could lend to the duress defense. That anything that the psychologist could have testified to would lead right back to a guilty but mentally ill defense.
Well, is there a case that holds that? Because in different areas, you know, in Wheat and Powell, where we talked about delayed reporting for children, we said expert testimony would be helpful because it wasn't intuitively obvious to people that delayed reporting was a typical phenomenon, but it turns out it is. In the battered wife syndrome, there's all sorts of expert testimony about dependency. And so my question is, are there cases that say unequivocally there's no expert testimony in support of a duress defense?
Some courts have found, there's at least one court that has found in Virginia that found that expert testimony actually went to the ultimate issue and therefore could not be admissible in a duress defense.
Well, to follow up on Justice.
That must be a unique Virginia rule, because we still let experts talk
to the
and
ultimate.
Give opinions on the ultimate issue. So how's that helpful?
That's the only case that I'm familiar with that dealt specifically with duress and expert testimony in that context.
Sorry.
To follow up on Justice Holland's question, couldn't you have a situation where the victim, not the victim, but the defendant that claims duress has the opportunity to get away in a physical sense? That is, the door is open and she can always walk away, but psychologically she's trapped because she really doesn't believe that she is free to leave.
And that would not meet this legal standard for a duress.
Why not?
Because it is a reasonable person test. It is not a test of a person with these particular psychological and mental infirmities that prevent them from doing what a reasonable person would do.
Well, what about the portion of the statute that refers to under the circumstances that this individual faced at the time?
I'm sorry, Aaron.
How do you limit that phraseology?
The circumstances go to the situation of her perception of the threat, whether it, as the state wrote in their supplemental briefing, that the concept was that someone could say, and there could be clearly objective testimony that the coercer said, "I will kill you if you don't do that." You have to put that statement into circumstances that would make it a real threat, as opposed to a 2-year-old having a tantrum. Those are the circumstances surrounding the threat. Would it be a real threat?
Well,
and that's a subjective portion.
Well, maybe I'm asking the same question, but the statute says that it's an affirmative defense if the defendant felt that he was coerced, he or she. And then it says, by threat of force, which a reasonable person, objective standard, in the defendant's situation would have been unable to resist. And you're telling us that in the defendant's situation refers only to the physical location of where the defendant is when the threat is made, or specifics about who made the threat, and it can't include as defendant's situation being defendant's state of mind or level of being subjected to somebody else's control over a period of time?
That's correct, because that would be, in fact, a guilty but mentally ill defense, stating that one was mentally ill and so one could not do what a normal person would do, which would be to leave when the opportunity arose.
What if you have a person with a cognitive disability, such a degree that under no circumstances could you be comfortable that a reasonable person would perceive things and be feel compelled to do X, Y, or Z in the same way, and not offer any, not be able to explain to the jury that there is this cognitive deficit that's proffered in support of duress that might not apply to the general run of the public. Are you saying that because someone has a cognitive deficit that they're not entitled to the duress defense, that you have to have some level of acuity, of mental acuity, in order to avail yourself of this affirmative defense? Otherwise, you have to plead guilty but mentally ill. Isn't that what you're arguing?
In essence, yes, because if a defendant...
Well, how's a person with a cognitive deficit mentally ill?
What I'm saying is a person with a cognitive deficit would not know that what they were doing was a criminal act. If they know what they're doing...
Well, that's a jury question, because it would depend on the nature of the cognitive deficit and the extent to which it would affect those particular circumstances, similar to the language that Justice Berger just read, focused on that individual and what that individual's condition and situation was at the time. But you're basically saying the only people that are going to be able to avail themselves of the duress defense is the average person.
No, that's the state is saying that it's an objective test, and it, yes, it's rare that people can actually use a duress defense, and for a very good reason. People, the legislature clearly does not want people that just because they're more, they follow the leader, that they are no longer culpable.
Well, but that's why we have juries to determine the facts of whether the circumstances are such that a person is culpable or not culpable, and then makes the ultimate decision. Do you genuinely think that if this case went to the jury with a duress charge, that the jury would have come back with a different verdict?
I do not believe they would have found duress. No, absolutely not. Sincerely, the state contends that this was not a duress case. Was it sad and tragic? Absolutely. No question. But Shakira Wanham knew what she was doing. She fired four bullets in the back of his head at short, close range, sitting next to a four-year-old in a car seat. She had been at a friend's house for hours, full access to a phone, full access to her friend. She got in a car with a man she termed as her ex-boyfriend, a friend who wanted to see her, that she ultimately killed. He got out of the car for a period of time while she sat there and waited for him to come back, and then she shot him? That's duress? The state would contend there is no duress.
And it would be a terrific argument, just as you made it, to a jury, wouldn't it? But isn't it the jury's job to resolve that?
When there is no credible evidence on an element of the crime, then the judge properly exercises a gatekeeping function and prevents that defense from going to the jury.
Suppose we're to agree with you on these facts, duress is not a defense to the charge of homicide, whether that be murder, manslaughter, or whatever. But it certainly was a defense, an affirmative defense to the charge of robbery. How do you respond to that?
Assuming that it was a defense to the robbery, or?
Well, yeah, Ms. Walker says, in any event, we would have had a duress defense to the robbery charge, you know, even if duress would not have been a proper defense to the homicide charges.
Well, the state contends that there is still no evidence as to the second prong that a reasonable person would have been able to avoid this. She certainly could have avoided the robbery. But even if there were duress to the robbery, there certainly, as you say, was nothing to the homicide.
So if the boyfriend says, if you don't go out and rob someone, I'm going to beat the hell out of you, that's not defense. That's not duress.
Not without the second step, which is that a reasonable person in that situation couldn't get away. She had ample opportunity. There was no evidence that a reasonable person.
Now, your argument was there was no credible evidence on the second aspect of the duress defense.
Correct.
And assuming that's correct, then the jury was not instructed either on the robbery or the homicide. But that goes back to the primary question that appears to be, should expert testimony ever be allowed on that second aspect of the defense? And as I understand the state's argument, it's no.
That's
as a matter of law, we should hold in this case expert testimony is never admissible in support of the second aspect of a duress defense?
Certainly no expert testimony as to mental condition or psychological idiosyncrasies. I don't want to preclude some expert testifying as to whether you could climb out a car, something like that.
The mental test.
The mental test, yes. The state would contend that that brings it right back to what the legislature has already determined that they feel would be a guilty, but more appropriately a guilty but mentally ill. And, in fact, the defense asked that she be sentenced under the guilty but mentally ill post-trial.
Are you conceding that there was a threat to use force in this case?
The state is conceding that the defendant testified, yes, that there was a threat.
Well,
and that aspect, there was some credible evidence that would have on that aspect, yes. But there was no credible evidence as to the second part.
What was the threat? Maybe I've missed that.
Well, there was no specific threat, but there are plenty of cases out there that would agree that an interpretation, and she did testify that she had been beaten in the past for not performing a robbery. Whether or not that is proportionate and whether there should be a proportionality aspect is another issue. There is nothing specifically in the statute. And although similar defenses in Delaware certainly require some sort of proportionality, there is nothing specifically in the duress statute. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are many jurisdictions, as I mentioned before, that have an objective standard test and allow such testimony. California is one where it stated that
Now, when you're talking about such testimony, you're talking about
expert testimony. For example, in California versus Callahan, the court found the attorney to be ineffective because he didn't research whether or not found that if the defendant had been permitted to testify to the fear, then expert testimony could have bolstered the reasonableness of the defense.
Let me make sure I understand that there is or is not a meaningful distinction between the facts that would have supported duress that were in the expert report and the actual opinion that might have been given by the expert if the expert had testified. Did the defense get into evidence, either at the stage before the judge ruled the duress defense out of the case in the form of ruling that she would not charge the jury on it? Had the jury heard and did the judge understand all of the facts that underlay the duress defense, apart from whatever opinion the expert might ultimately have given? Well, all the background about the relationship between the defendant and the 6'7", 290-pound boyfriend or whatever he was.
Whether she understood it or not, I don't know. But the record actually did show, she stated, over and over again, I was afraid he was going to beat me if I didn't do this, and that was sufficient for duress. What the expert report would have done, and the state is incorrect, wasn't just based on what she told her. It was based on many, many objective reports and records from schools and detention centers, et cetera, and the doctor gave an opinion that by the time Ms. Wonin was sent.
That's where I am having some difficulty.
Okay.
Put the opinion aside for a moment.
Okay.
The facts that caused the expert to reach certain conclusions that might have been offered as an opinion if accepted, were all those facts in support of her circumstances, her situation at the time, were those all before the judge before she ruled the defense out of the case?
No, they were not. They contained a broader scope of her relationship with Mr. Martin and her history of being abused, and the doctor gave an opinion that by the time Ms. Wonin was sent by her boyfriend to get money for him, she had two choices, to be a victim or to be a victimizer.
Well, all of those facts, again, segregating entirely the opinion that might have been given, would all of those facts, in your view, have a bearing on a jury fact-finding about whether or not the defendant was under duress and that duress was the reason that she committed the crime?
Absolutely. The doctor reviewed reports and found that since the age of five, Ms. Wonham had been repeatedly sexually and physically abused by older men. In fact, when she was 13, a 50-year-old man pimped her out to other older men on a regular basis.
Now, the state has suggested that all the facts in that expert report were nothing more than what the defendant had told the expert. But now, you're suggesting there's more to it than that.
Absolutely. She based this, there's several pages of the report. She annotates that it was from all these other resources, and then she separates out what Ms. Wonham told her. It was school.
Am I correct that the record shows the ruling about not instructing the jury on duress came after your client testified?
That's correct.
So your client got to say everything your client wanted to say without the expert.
Correct.
Then, having heard the testimony, the judge said, as a matter of law, that testimony doesn't support a duress instruction.
That's correct. And in fact, what she found, apart from it being an incorrect memory, was what the old standard was under the common law. They were barriers. They could have been barriers at that time.
So your argument is twofold. First, based on your client's testimony alone, there should have been a duress instruction.
Correct.
And second, to the extent your client's testimony was deficient, it would have been enhanced by the expert's testimony.
Correct. That's absolutely correct. I did want to point out one final thing, and that is this court in Alexander versus Cahill was determining whether choice of evils defenses applied to civil cases. And it found that in that case, it was a bus driver who was sued for being negligent for letting kids off at the wrong bus stop. And she said, I did that because these kids have been, you know, I was scared and they had been threatening me before. And this court held, but for a procedural bar based on a pattern of threats and behavior of the coercers, the defense would have been permissible. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.